Okay, thank you so much. That's a very kind introduction. Lovely to be back. And this course is a little bit chronological, but it's not just chronological. I want to sort of explore the very tangled history that Jews and Christians have. And I wanted to start by just suggesting some principles that are really useful when we are talking about different religions from our own. And the relationship between Jews and Christians, as we all know, has a lot of baggage, and we all come with that baggage. There's the legacy of mutual suspicion and distrust for centuries, the legacy of persecutions and forced conversions, the legacy of the Holocaust, the whole situation in the modern Middle East, and some of the Christian church's reaction to that. So we come with a great deal of baggage when we're talking about Christianity, and it was summarized in an excellent way by Benjamin Disraeli, who said, "The Jews are a nervous people. 19 centuries of Christian love have taken a toll," which I think puts it very well indeed. So we need to recognize we do have baggage, but we also probably, if we possibly can, need to break out of this sort of relationship with other religions, including the tendency that we all naturally have to regard them as monolithic and unchanging. So suggested rules of engagement, if you like, put them up here because they appear at the beginning of the handout. Number one, avoiding disputation. We don't have to assume that everything the other tradition says is denied by our own tradition. It's not a zero-sum game. It's not win or lose. So that's a sort of useful principle to remember. Avoiding proselytization. We don't learn about other religions in order to convert to them, or for them people to convert people from other religions to our own faith. That's just not the point of interfaith exploration. Avoid syncretism. We also don't try and replace separate religions by jumbling all up and saying there's some meaningful blend of them all together, which is very untrue to everybody's tradition. Avoiding relativism. We don't have to give up our religion's claim to truth, or claim that all religious truth is relative anyway, so it doesn't matter. We can hang on to our own beliefs of what is true and what isn't true. And lastly, avoiding triumphalism. We don't have to assume that we have a complete monopoly on truth, and that Christianity is just a deviant form of Judaism. And for Christians, they don't have to assume that Judaism is just a precursor to Christianity. And we don't really have to feel that, oh, history will prove us right and them wrong. After all, none of us knows the end of the story. So those rules are very helpful, both when we are talking among ourselves, about other religions, and also when we are engaging in dialogue with members of other faiths. And I found them a useful thing to come back to in many interfaith situations. So we don't have to do any of those things. And we are absolutely fine going, "I still don't actually think your religion is true, mine is, but that's absolutely fine. I still want to learn about your religion. That's okay." Okay. And just to look at some of the stereotypes, Christian stereotypes of Judaism and Jewish stereotypes of Christianity, I just want to have a look at a couple of texts here too. I think everyone would agree that the origins of Christianity are Jewish, for a start. Jesus and his disciples were all Jews. And there are still Christians who would deny that, but I think most Christians have come around to the idea that, okay, yes, that is just historically true and that's it. So it's not at all surprising that the relationship between the two religions has been quite fraught from very early on, because they are intimately related. The nature of that relationship is not absolutely clear. We'll be talking a bit about that. How did Judaism and Christianity come to be two different things when they didn't start off that way? So that's something that we'll look at, and something that I think is sometimes quite hard to get your head around. And if we think about Christianity as a whole, we also are going to have to discuss Jesus, because Jesus is central to Christianity rather naturally. And for Christians, you could sort of compare it in a way. Jesus occupies much the role that the Torah does for Jews. It's the central link. He's the central link to God for Christians, as Torah is our central link to God for us. And for better or worse, The two faiths have interacted constantly throughout history. And we're going to explore that during this course. And we have to also remember that history itself is written by people. History is constructed by people who use it and who write it and who think about it. So it's very difficult to claim that we have an absolute historical view. And we need to realize that actually we privilege some things, we've lost information on other things. We don't always know exactly what happened in the past. That's not to deny that there has been a Christian tendency to view Judaism as a bit of a fossil, something that has no use anymore, that's superseded by a new truth. And going along with that, viewing Jews as people who are willfully blind to the truth. And we do have to recognize there have been parallel Jewish versions of that, Jewish stereotypes of Christians as all out to get us, and Christianity is a perversion of Jewish truth. So just to look at some old-fashioned, if you have a look at the date, you'll say these are not current stereotypes at that time. And the first is from the 1910 Catholic Encyclopedia, which says helpfully, the kingdom of God as described and founded by Jesus has an historical name. It is the Christian Church, which was able silently to leaven the Roman Empire, which has outlived the ruin of the Jewish temple and its worship, and which in the course of centuries has extended to the confines of the world the knowledge and the worship of the God of Abraham, while Judaism has remained the barren fig tree which Jesus condemned during his mortal life, referring to one of Jesus' parables. Well, it's not exactly complimentary. I'm glad to tell you the Catholic Church has grown up a lot since 1910, and in probably the final session, we will look at advances in modern Christian understandings of Judaism. But back in 1910, that's what the Christian Church, the Catholic Church had to say about Judaism. Old, sterile, barren, and just ruined, gone. Jews also thought things about Christians. Here is the Jewish Encyclopedia from 1906, which is also in its way a stereotype. Paul, the real founder of the Christian Church, construed the belief in the atoning death of Christ held by the rest into a system altogether antagonistic to Judaism and its law, claiming to have received the apostleship to the heathen world from the Christ he beheld in his visions. He deprived faith, as typified by Abraham, of its naturalness, and forged the shackles of the Christian dogma with its terrors of damnation and hell for the unbeliever. The medieval church divided men into believers and unbelievers who are to inherit heaven and hell respectively. With the love which she poured forth as the fountain of divine grace, she also sent forth streams of hatred. Which again is not a very complimentary picture of Christianity and doesn't really necessarily recognize the variety of Christian belief, including Christian belief about Jews. But again, 1906. So I think we've all grown up a bit since those days. The Holocaust was a major shock to the Christian world. And these days, both sides have had to put down their baggage and misconceptions and start talking to each other and finding out more about each other. And here's a much more modern 1962 meditation on this. Jews must rise above the heavy burden of historical memories, which have made it difficult for them to achieve any real understanding, let alone an appreciation of Christianity. It is not easy to wipe out the memories of centuries of persecution and massacre, all too often dedicated to the advancement of the cause of the Prince of Peace, one of the titles of Jesus, again taken from the Tanakh. It is no easy task for Jews to divest themselves of the heavy burden of group memories from the past, which are unfortunately reinforced all too often by personal experiences in the present. You know, Christian anti-Semitism is not dead and gone away. There are still instances of it. Nevertheless, the effort must be made if men are to emerge from the dark heritage of religious hatred, which has embittered their mutual relationships for 20 centuries. There is need for Jews to surrender the stereotype of Christianity as being monolithic and unchanging, and to recognize the ramifications of viewpoint and emphasis that constitute the multicolored spectrum of contemporary Christianity. In other words, you can't keep reverting to the Middle Ages and justifying hatred of Christians. You know, things have changed, which is good. And we will look at that too. So I just wanted to mention that first because I know that people come to learning about Christianity, sometimes with very intense personal baggage. And I wouldn't mean, I wanted just to acknowledge the fact that that exists and say, okay, we also have to make quite an effort in some ways. I'm just going to pause here and look at the chat because I see people have written a couple of things. Part of Malka says part of Christian dogma until recently with Jews were damned because they reject Christianity and condemned perpetual servitude. Yes, and we'll talking about that. By 1962, weren't the Christians still hating on the Pharisees? Well, which Christians? Protestants, Catholics, Orthodox Church? Again, by 1962, you have several hundred different denominations and they are not speaking with one voice again. So that part of this unpacking that I hope we're doing during this course is also to talk about varieties of Christianity in differing attitudes, especially in the modern times. Different attitudes in the ivory tower, universities in the street. Absolutely. In Judaism too. Yeah. And that is that leads me on nicely to a beautiful segue into our next portion. So what are we going to do first of all? We're going to think about Jesus. And I want today to think about Jesus, the historical figure. Now, for every religion, you have the internal religious or faith view of what happened. So we know this perfectly well. Moshe got the tablets at Mount Sinai, received the whole Torah, etc., etc. You know, these are things that are central to our own understanding of our faith. And then there is the historical, the academic view, or the outsider view, if you like, which might say, for instance, in the study of the Bible, might say, well, actually, no, the Torah wasn't a done deal in about 1200 BCE. It was written in Babylon by various exiled Jews during the Babylonian exile. And then other books are written much later than that. And maybe the whole thing was edited. So again, we know from our own religion that there are both faith views and academic or historical views. I don't really see any necessity to privilege one over the other, just to recognize they're different. And the same is true of Christianity as well. You don't actually have to, you know, sort of say, well, you know, their faith view is wrong and only the historical view is true, because I don't think we'd appreciate it if people said, well, your faith view is wrong and only the historical view or the academic view is true. So we can hold those in tension. We can say, I absolutely understand that this is the faith view of certain portions of the Christian community today. Just as I can say, okay, I can understand that different Jews have different ideas, for instance, about the origin of the Torah today. And I may believe in one, and that's absolutely fine, but I recognize there's more than one opinion out there. And also I'm interested in both aspects of these. So what we'll do this week is we will look about what we know about the historical, the academic picture of Jesus. And next week we will look at the Gospels, at the faith picture of Jesus, and see how they differ and also where we have different ideas about this. So how do we know anything at all about Jesus? The first source to go to, as you would imagine, would be the New Testament. And we need to look at that, not just the text, but who wrote various books, when did they write them, what do we know about the background of them. So we're going to start off with a historical consideration of the New Testament. We'll read extracts from the New Testament next week. And here we might have a helpful chart, which I've put up of the actual contents of the New Testament. And you can see it sort of goes down to there. Well, I'll just go through it quickly and then we'll go back to the Gospels, which is our main interest. So we have four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. They may sound familiar. They all deal with the life of Jesus. Then we have the Acts of the Apostles, which is about what happens after Jesus dies and introduces the character of Paul and the various people who helped him spread Christianity around the Mediterranean. We have what's called the Pauline Epistles, letters by Paul. Not all of them would be accepted as being by Paul by academics. We have the general, or sometimes they're called the Catholic, which actually means worldwide epistles. Often we don't know who they're by. And we have a very odd book, the Book of Revelation, which is apocalyptic visions, including visions at the end of days, and is quite unlike anything at all in the New Testament. I might add, we have no idea who wrote it. So we're going to focus on the Gospels because they are the ones that contain the earliest, or maybe not the earliest, as we'll see, but they do contain the life of Jesus, and for that reason are central to the faith view. But as documents, we also have to evaluate them if we're interested in the historical view. How reliable are they? What do we know about who composed them, when they composed them, why they composed them, and the texts that we have today, do we have, you know, how far back do those texts actually go of the Gospels? So you'll see that three of them I've marked synoptic. Matthew, Mark, Luke are known as the synoptic Gospels, and that is because they form a set. They don't match, but you can often put them in columns next to each other, and then you can say, oh, look, this story actually does appear in this one. And none of the stories appear in all three Gospels, but you can trace links backwards and forwards. It's story-based, and they give different views of the life of Jesus. Some of them miss out the birth stories, for instance. They all focus on the last week of Jesus' life. The fourth Gospel, the Gospel of John, is a life of Jesus, but it doesn't fit in very well with the other three. It's quite different in character. So it's the non-synoptic Gospel, if you like. Gospel itself is an old English word. The original word was evangelion in Latin, or euangelion in Greek, and it means the good tidings, the besora, if you like, the good news, which is actually what gospel means in English. It's the good telling, the good account. So that's why they're known as gospels. They were all written in Greek. We don't have the original manuscripts. Our earliest manuscripts date from around about 200 CE. We have the first manuscripts. They presumably rest upon earlier manuscripts, but we just don't have those at all. So it's a little bit difficult to know this, you know, what exactly is the historical value, how far exactly, you know, the versions of the Gospels we know now, are they the same? It does seem that they aren't. They were copied and recopied over the centuries, and modern scholars, again, academic, this is not necessarily the faith view, would definitely suggest there have been additions. So a very well-known example that most academics accept is the last verses of the Gospel of Mark, chapter 16, verses 9 to 20, which record Jesus's resurrection. And that apparently didn't appear in the original version of Mark. It was tacked on at the end. And there are other bits and pieces that scholars would claim have been tacked in or moved from one to another, or somebody sort of put in their own little version here. Again, there's a whole field of scholarship on this. Now, depending on what type of Christian you are, you would or would not accept these scholarly evaluations. So in the Protestant world, outside the evangelical world, you would probably find a lot of Christians who go, that's fine by me. These are human documents. They don't claim to have come from God. They were written by human authors. And I'm not at all surprised that they took a while to settle down into a fixed form. And I quite accept that maybe bits and pieces were added later. In other parts of the Christian world, notably the evangelical movement, and I would think probably the Orthodox Church, it says, no, these men were divinely inspired and these are written by people who knew Jesus, and they go right back to his life and they're historically reliable. So even within Christianity, the faith picture and the historical picture might not actually be the same right across different denominations. Okay, so what do we know from an academic viewpoint about those four Gospels, and who wrote them? The Gospels themselves are anonymous. They don't say. And the traditional labels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John are just that. They are traditional labels, but they don't appear in the text, which is interesting. We don't know with any certainty who these authors were, nor for whom they were writing, nor when they wrote. Nowadays, Mark is often understood by scholars as the earliest Gospel. An older view was that it was based on the Gospel of Matthew, but that view has gone. Mark himself is, again, traditionally, I'm going to be using this word a lot, identified as a Jew, a cousin of Barnabas, who was a companion of Paul. But it doesn't say so in the Gospel itself. These are traditional attributions. And this Gospel, Mark's Gospel, tells the story of Jesus's life. It leaps into the story at his baptism as an adult, misses out the birth, and the childhood not interested in that at all. And there's particular attention to the last week of Jesus's life. And it very much shows him as a man of action who heals and drives out spirits and performs miracles. And that's really the focus of Mark. The Gospel of Matthew, very different. Traditionally attributed to Jesus's disciple Matthew, who is mentioned in chapter 9. Most scholars don't accept that at all and think it was written by an anonymous Jewish follower of Jesus towards the end of the first century CE. And it is the most closely linked to Jewish tradition of the four Gospels. We'll sample some next week. The author arranges Jesus's teaching into five sermons. Maybe that's meant as a deliberate parallel to the five books of the Torah. It also constantly throughout the Gospel stresses Jesus's life and actions as fulfilling passages from Tanakh, from the Jewish Bible, which it sees as prophecies, sort of reading backwards. Says, oh, that he did in order to fulfill that which was written. So it's a backward looking attitude to the, what for Christians becomes the Old Testament, or Tanakh, which reads it into the life of Jesus. And we'll look at that in more detail next week. And some of the very well-known parts of the story of Jesus only appear in the Gospel of Matthew, like the, especially infancy stories, like the three wise men who come to visit the baby Jesus, the flight of Jesus and his family into Egypt, and Herod's massacre of the innocents, which is clearly based on Pharaoh's trying to kill Jewish infants back in the time of the Exodus. The longest Gospel is the Gospel of Luke. It has a particular emphasis on social ethics, the poor and women, and a great interest in prayer. And again, this has some well-known stories like the Good Samaritan and the Prodigal Son that only appear in the Gospel of Luke and don't appear in the other Gospels. Tradition assigns it to Luke, who's also thought to have written the Acts of the Apostles. This is the book down here that comes immediately after the Gospels, that is sort of what happens after Jesus dies. And in the Acts of the Apostles, Luke is described as the beloved physician. So he's traditionally thought also to have written this gospel. Again, the gospel itself doesn't tell you. It does, however, start off saying, I have written this for you, my friend Theophilus. We don't know anything about Theophilus at all, but it was an account written for a particular person. So in this one, the author's thought possibly to have been a non-Jewish Greek or Syrian, and probably not Jewish at all. The last gospel, as we said, the Gospel of John, is not as one of the synoptics. It's a bit different. It's usually dated the later. Some people date it as late as 90 CE, so that will be a good 60 or so years after Jesus died. And it's the author's traditionally identified as Jesus's disciple John, which is probably unlikely given the late dating. He is described as the beloved disciple in this gospel. Modern scholars tend to think it's a composite document, perhaps from Ephesus, which is now in Turkey, and was finally edited and made into a single book in the late first century CE. And this is the only gospel where Jesus talks about himself. In the others, he talks a lot about the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God. And in this gospel alone, he is presented as the Logos, the incarnate word of God. None of the other gospels do that. And is actually declared to be God. None of the other Gospels do that. They talk about him as Son of God and Messiah, but none of the other three Gospels describe Jesus as actually being God. And the focus in the Gospel of John is on Jesus's miracles and on him rather than his message. And it seems to be intended for a non-Jewish audience. So if we look at the dates and think about these documents, our best source for the life of Jesus consists of accounts that were written at the very earliest 30 to 40 years after he died. At the latest estimates or the latest documents, 70 or more years after he died. And the earliest copies of those texts that we have survive from the late second century CE. So none of them appear to have been written during the lifetime of Jesus. And Jesus himself never wrote anything, as far as we know. We don't have any claims in the New Testament of a document that Jesus himself wrote. And if you think about these as biographies, well, it's like trying to write the biography of Yigal Alon, who died in 1980 now. It's quite a while back. Most of us would be taxed to remember actually all the stuff he did. Some of us might have met him, but our memories might not be brilliant. So their historical value is somewhat in dispute as to they're not eyewitness accounts, very clearly. And that's our best evidence. I'm going to pause here and see what people put in the chat. As I said, what language the Gospels written in? They're all written in Greek. We're going to talk about the Talmud. just briefly, anything that mentions Jesus in the Talmud, and there are bits that were cut out by censors, but we have them. They're all much later, 4th, 5th century, the earliest. It's disturbing when the introduction clues negative. Christians had negative to say about Jews, just like Jews had negative to say about Christians. Unfair light of what Christianity has done to Jews and continues to do so. A bit insulting. Well, I'm sorry you feel like that. I don't know. It's well, you know, Jews have had negative things to say about Christians. Yes, we haven't massacred Christians the way that Jews have been massacred by Christians. I absolutely agree. It's it hasn't been an equal playing field. We have been a small minority, and very difficult for us to exert and do nasty things to the other. Though I may say in modern Israel, there's quite a bit of burning of churches and things. Recently, the Protestant cemetery on Mount Zion was vandalized by Jews. Not a good look. So I'm not really trying to compare them or say who is better or who is nicer. I'm just saying that we do need to look at our own stereotypes about Christians and maybe reevaluate them. We might not all come to the same conclusion at all, but if we're trying to be the best people we can be, we do need to recognize our own biases and prejudices where they do exist. I hope that doesn't sound insulting, but you know, none of us are perfect, basically. Which of any of the Gospels was written with an awareness of another Gospel? Huge academic arguments about this. Some Gospels seem to be reliant. It mostly goes in date order, obviously, but huge, huge arguments about that. Well, we touched on the editing of the Torah so it predicts the coming of Jesus. Who has edited the Torah to predict the coming of Jesus? There are people who have read the coming of Jesus in the Torah, but I don't think they've edited it. They've just done, from a Jewish point of view, somewhat pretentious commentary on the Torah, but I don't know of any Christian editing of the Torah. If you do know, let me know. Are any of these Gospels influenced by whether the temple was in existence or not? Yes, there are accounts of Jesus visiting the temple, absolutely, and some of them may have been written before the temple was destroyed. And wait a minute, what's Suzanne Broner? Editing the Torah. Oh, the Greek. If you're talking about Septuagint, this is very unlikely because the Septuagint was written, was translated into Greek about 300 BCE by Jews in Egypt. So I don't know that it really has been edited to reflect the coming of Jesus. And we have fairly early fragments of the Septuagint. So I don't know if it was edited. Again, certain words were interpreted in certain ways. Very famously, the word Parthenos, which was used to translate the Hebrew Alma. And Parthenos tends to, but not always, means a virgin. And that was picked up by later commentators. There you are, as I predicted, virgin birth. I have to tell you, the virgin birth wasn't even a thing in Christianity for the first couple of hundred years. So again, this is later interpretation. It's not editing. It's later picking up a translated word and taking it in a direction it probably didn't even mean in the translation originally. I hope that answers that question. Okay, so is this the only evidence we have? The rest of the New Testament is a bit irrelevant for understanding the historical Jesus because it doesn't claim to tell you about the historical Jesus at all. So we can sort of forget the rest of the New Testament if we're looking at historical Jesus questions. So what else have we got? We have got a variety of bits of evidence. Not brilliant, any of them. We have what are called the non-canonical Gospels. An example is the Gospel of Thomas. Again, later probably than the canonical Gospels, the ones that are in the New Testament. That might be late 1st, early 2nd century CE. There's a Gospel of Mary, Gospel of Philip, but most of them are late 2nd century CE onwards. So as historical evidence, they're less valuable because they're less close to the time of Jesus. We'll talk about them a bit more, but they basically don't really get into the official canon of the New Testament. And that seems to have taken a while in itself. We're just used to things, you know, this box called the New Testament. But it took a while for that to evolve. And our earliest mention of four Gospels that are considered as official is in 160 CE by the early Christian writer Irenaeus. Another early Christian writer seems to have been using all the 27 books of the New Testament by about 200 CE. But some of the epistles were still being argued about. They weren't all definitely accepted by everyone as genuine. Well, they should be in there. Really, the New Testament settles down about the earth 367. The early church father Athenaeus calls it a canon, a fixed set, rather parallel, actually, to the composition of the Tanakh, where the Torah was always in, most of the Nevi'im were in, but many of the Ketuvim continued to be discussed by the rabbis, as you can see in the Mishnah and elsewhere. It probably wasn't time, several of the books like Shir HaShirim and Kohelet were argued about by the rabbis well into the time of Rabbi Akiva, which is 132 CE-ish, second century. We still haven't quite put the lid on the Tanakh. So it's not surprising that the New Testament took a while to calm down. The non-canonical Gospels that didn't make it into the New Testament, we know about them because they've been dug up from Egypt. A place called Nag Hammadi had a whole treasure trove of later manuscripts for them, of these much earlier texts. They were found in 1945. They used to be called Gnostic Gospels, but the term has fallen out of favor. And the versions we have, for instance, including the Gospel of Thomas, are often in Coptic, which is a late form of the ancient Egyptian language written in a largely Greek alphabet. I've just been to see the Coptic Orthodox Church. It's very relevant for me. And the Gospel of Thomas, for instance, to look at that one because it's one of the best known, it consists of 114 sayings attributed to Jesus, but it's not an account of his life like the canonical Gospels. Estimates of its dates vary from 60 CE to 140 CE, but it's no use in telling you about a historical Jesus because it doesn't tell you about his life. It just says, Jesus said, and then you have all these sayings. Some scholars see these non-canonical texts as just as authoritative in historical terms as the canonical Gospels, the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John ones, but others, including most of the official churches, regard them as the productions of heretical groups and don't accept them in any way, shape or form and don't recognize them as authoritative. This is the sort of text that comes up in books like the Da Vinci Code, early but non-canonical Christian text. But we have to say they're not much use historically to us trying to find out about the historical Jesus because they're all too late. They don't help us at all. I'm just going to pause and look at the chat. Meant that the Christians after the destruction of the temple could use that as God rejected the Jews. Indeed, and they did, but it's not quite clear whether all the Gospels were written before or after the year 70. There are claims that some of them do seem to be pre-70, or certainly the Acts of the Apostles seems to be pre-70. And not as written, it was my impression or early teaching that early Christians indicated 100 plus miracles in the Old Testament, their version that predicted the coming of Jesus. Never heard about this, but if you can find a source for it, we'll be very interested to learn. I think they thought they simply took Tanakh Torah lines out of context. Yes, or we could put that a different and maybe slightly less antagonistic way and say they had completely different interpretations from Jews. Early Christians interpreted the Tanakh in very, very different ways from us. I must say we have also quite a variety of early interpretation ourselves. Were there disagreements about what book should be in the Christian Bible between Copts, Orthodox and Catholics? Yes, to some extent there were. The Catholics accept as part of their Bible, they have the Old Testament, the New Testament, what they call the Apocrypha, which are a series of Jewish authored books like Books of the Maccabees, first two Books of the Maccabees, Tobit, Ben Sira, and various other books. They accept that as a sort of division of the Bible. Protestants rejected that and stripped it down to Old Testament, New Testament. That's it. The Eastern Orthodox churches often have the Apocrypha, and they often have books that get classified these days as pseudepigrapha, which are books like the Book of Enoch. Again, very often Jewish authored, but very often preserved by Christians, so possibly Christian edited later on. So Wikipedia has a wonderful chart about the biblical canon and how that relates to different denominations. So no, they're not absolutely identical. I think they all have Old Testament, their name for Tanakh, and New Testament in. After that, depends which denomination you're talking about. Okay, so we've seen that the non-canonicals, though charming and interesting and suggestive about early Christian ideas that then got edited out because that wasn't acceptable Christianity anymore, but they're not much used to historical analysis of who was Jesus. What else have we got? We have got the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, who you probably know about. Now, he lives roughly 37 to 100 CE. In other words, he's barely born and Jesus has already been dead for a while. And in his book, the the Jewish Antiquities, which is his version of Jewish history, there is a passage known as the Testimonium Flavianum, the Flavianic Testimony, if you like, which has been much cited over the years. And this is all of it. It says, in the middle of his account of Jewish history, about this time there lived Jesus, a wise man, if indeed one ought to call him a man. For he was one who performed surprising deeds and was a teacher of such people as accept the truth gladly. He won over many Jews and many of the Greeks. He was the Messiah, ho Christos, and Christ is the Greek for Mashiach, anointed person, which is where this title comes from. And when, upon the accusation of the principal men among us, Pilate had him condemned to a cross, those who had first come to love him did not cease. He appeared to them spending a third day restored to life, but the prophets of God had foretold these things and 1,000 other marvels about him. And the tribe of the Christians, so called after him, has still to this day not disappeared. Now, this is a surprising paragraph to find in a Jewish work. And since the 18th century, scholars have questioned whether it really is Josephus, or whether it got shoved into an early copy because, some early Christian thought, ooh, it's impossible that Josephus didn't notice the existence of Jesus. So I'll just put in what he should have written, which I think the bulk of academic opinion is this is not genuinely Josephus. This is a later insert. But even if it were genuine, it's absolutely no use at all. It doesn't tell you anything about Jesus that we don't know from the Gospels. It really sounds like a summation of basic Christian beliefs about Jesus. And it doesn't give you any interesting insights whatsoever. So it really probably is a later thing. And even if it weren't, it's useless for historical understanding. Okay, so that's no good. What about contemporary Roman literature? Did anyone notice Jesus? Well, the answer is not really. They did notice Christians, however. So we're going to look at the two best of these mentions in Greco-Roman literature by the historians Tacitus and Suetonius. And in Tacitus, it's Annals, a history of his times, written again, you note the late date, 116 CE. He talks about Christians in Rome. And this is under the Emperor Nero, who very famously persecuted Christians. Consequently, to get rid of the report that he'd started the great fire in Rome in 64 CE, the Emperor Nero fastened the guilt and inflicted the most exquisite tortures on a class hated for their abominations, called Christians by the populace. Tacitus think they're disgusting people anyway, but they acted as a scapegoat for Nero. Christus, from whom the name had its origin, suffered the extreme penalty during the reign of Tiberius, by the emperor, at the hands of one of our procurators, Pontius Pilate, or Pilatus, and a most mischievous superstition, thus checked for the moment, again broke out not only in Judea, the first source of the evil, but even in Rome, where all things hideous and shameful from every part of the world find their centre and become popular. So Tacitus is no Christian lover. He thinks they're disgusting people, but he's heard the story. And roughly, there's some points there that seem to confirm the Gospels. Happens during the reign of the Emperor Tiberius. Yep. He is condemned to death by Pontius Pilatus, the governor of Judea. Yep. And there he had followers. It started off in Judea, but has spread to Rome certainly by 116, and he claims by 64 CE. So that's quite interesting. Doesn't tell us much about Jesus, except the dating, Tiberius and Pontius Pilatus, but certainly tells us that there are early Christians in Rome. So that's a valuable bit of historical evidence. But it doesn't tell us any more about what Jesus was like or what he did, really. And we have in Suetonius, who's writing the Lives of the 12 Caesars. This is 121, so again, a bit late. As the Jews were making constant disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, the Emperor Claudius, who ruled 49 to 54, expelled them from Rome. So he's not talking about Christians at all, he's talking about Jews. Can he not distinguish between Christians, Jews who are following Jesus and Jews who are not following Jesus, and maybe they are fighting among themselves, and this is what's going on, so it just chucks them all out, because at this stage, the Romans can't really tell any difference between Christians and Jews. They're all fighting about this person called Crestus, who you can see Suetonius is not interested in, which is an interesting throwaway, that by the time of Suetonius, you could be a very educated Roman and not really understand the difference between Jews and Christians, which argues that maybe there weren't an awful lot of differences between Jews and Christians at this point. So that's all the help we get from Roman literature. Rabbinic literature, what about that? Okay, somebody asked before, is it true that there's mentions of Jesus in the Talmud? Yes, there are. But if we look at, there's nothing in the Mishnah, which is about 200 CE, already late. Tosefta, maybe, nobody agrees on the date of the Tosefta, maybe 250 CE. Jerusalem Talmud, Babylonian Talmud, you can see the dates, 400, 600. They're all much, 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 much later than Jesus. The material that exists in the Talmud is fairly anti this person. He's called Yeshu, which seems to be a contemptuous form of Yehoshua, which probably was his name. Yesus is a Greek form of Yehoshua. But they all are a couple of centuries later, at the very earliest, than the historical Jesus. And they seem to be much more of a reaction to early Christians than they are documentation of the real historical Jesus. And they're known collectively as the Toldot Yeshu, the history of Jesus. Christian censors much later on demanded they be removed from copies of the Talmud, and they were. But we have copies of the Talmud that weren't censored. And you can get the Toldot Yeshu as a little separate book. It's pretty scurrilous stuff. It sort of says this person, Yeshu, was, you know, daughter of a Roman soldier and a prostitute. It's very rude. But that's really by the time that Christian-Jewish relations are pretty bad. And it's just reflecting that. It's reflecting we don't like the Christians. It's not telling you any historical traditions about Jesus as a person at all. They're not contemporary. Okay. Last bit of evidence. What about archaeology? Have we dug up anything about Jesus? The answer is no. Now, you might have heard recently about an ossuary, a stone box for holding bones. Jewish practice in the Second Temple period was to put you in a cave for a year or so and then come and collect your bones, anoint them with oil, wrap them up in a nice cloth and put them in an ossuary. It's amazing that the Jewish burial has changed so much since then. And one was found that had the inscription, James, or probably Yaakov, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. And everyone went, oh my heavens. He's a brother of somebody called Jesus and the father's called Joseph. It's Jesus. So everyone was very excited, particularly in the Christian world. But after investigation, it was found the inscription was a modern forgery scratched onto an ancient artifact. So that went down to Jews. And the only thing that archaeology can do to help us with the historical Jesus is give some idea of the conditions of life at the time, the general trends, for instance, the pervasive spread of the cult of the Roman emperor, who was worshipped and described as the son of God and the savior, terms that then got taken over for Jesus a bit later on. And of course, has political implications for the status of Jesus. So how can we sum it up? What do we know about Jesus? Very, very little. And if you want the academic view, then we could agree that Jesus did exist, though there is a minority of academics who don't think he did. He was born somewhere between 7 and 2 BCE, because the traditional date is completely wrong by all accounts. He lived in the Galilee. He was baptized, that he was dunked in a mikveh as some process of purification and renewal by a man called John. That he taught, he preached, he debated with other Jews, he engaged in healing and exorcism, like many religious figures of his day, used parables, Mishalim, that great Jewish tradition, gathered followers in Galilee, went to Jerusalem and ended up crucified by Roman soldiers during the governorship of Pontius Pilate, who was around 26 to 36 CE. And that's all we know. Everything else, and some of this, is very hotly debated. That has not stopped people looking for the historical Jesus, and the search for the historical Jesus has been going on ever since the 18th century, and it continues today. And it's principally characterized by researchers in every age coming up with a picture of Jesus that matches their own ideals. So you've got a liberal non-Jewish Jesus for the late 19th century, for the Protestant German researchers then. You have a Marxist revolutionary Jesus for liberation theologians of the late 20th century. There are feminist Jesuses, rabbi Jesuses, etc., etc. It rather depends on who's writing the story. It is absolutely fascinating, not least for the light it throws on the ideals and the concerns of each period, but it's completely inconclusive. And if you want to read an excellent book about it, try Charlotte Allen's The Human Christ, which I put at the end of the bibliography. I've listed it there, which is an absolutely fascinating book going through all the different versions of Jesus that have ever, ever been talked about. OK, so short answer is we don't really know. Can have a quick look at the chat, see if anyone's got any questions we should be dealing with. It's the name of Joshua, a play on words, just as the first Joshua brought Bnei Israel into the land. The new one does the same metaphorically. Well, people would have done that later, yes. But there's no reason at all to presume there wasn't a bloke called Jesus at this time, or Joshua at this time, Joshua. But lots of Jews called Yehoshua at the time. It's a terribly common name. So, you know, if he actually existed, he must have had a name, and Yehoshua is perfectly reasonable. Later on, people go, ah, why Yehoshua? Why is that his name? Oh, look, let's link him to a biblical figure with a different story. But there's no reason why a first century Jew shouldn't be called Yehoshua. And to be called something. Was there a mainstream Roman religion in 100 CE? Yes, the Roman Empire was still very pagan. The Roman gods were worshipped in Italy, and the emperor as a god and the goddess Roma, who symbolized the city of Rome, were the official gods all around the Roman Empire. And there were massive ceremonies. If you were a public magistrate or a citizen, you were meant to be seen at the ceremonies. The Jews had an out because it was recognized that the Jews were bonkers and wouldn't sacrifice to the emperor. So we had an out. But Christians who weren't Jews didn't have an out at all and often got themselves persecuted because they wouldn't take part in public sacrifices. Apart from that, there were all sorts of local gods who'd been faintly Romanized or identified with Roman gods that exist in the Roman pantheon. So local Syrian Baal type gods were often seen as Zeus or Jupiter in Latin and were identified with them. So yes, it was good old paganism, basically. Right. Oh, there are two more questions in the chat. Told us Yeshua wasn't an extract. It's rather its own scholarly standalone work. I think there also is a collection of the, isn't there a collection of the extracts that's called Toldot Yeshua? Is there more than one Toldot Yeshua? I'm not absolutely sure. There's a lovely book by Peter Schaefer about the figure of Jesus in rabbinic literature, which is very interesting and concludes basically it's not historic, it's a reaction to early Christians. So yes, I'm not quite sure. Maybe there are two things that could be called Toldot Yeshua. I'm not sure on that at all. Was Judea more problematic for Rome to rule than other provinces? To some extent, because Jews were the only nutters who just would not compromise and refused a perfectly reasonable request to worship the official gods of the Roman Empire. Everybody else got on with it. We were just very, very difficult. Oh, Torah Motion had a whole course. Oh, good. Well, excellent. So we obviously definitely have people who know what they're talking about here. Fantastic. My only point really is that none of it is historically based. I mean, none of it is, a first century account of Jesus as he was. It's all much later part of religious polemics. Okay, so what else can we say about the historical Jesus? We can look at the background he came from. We can look at what was going on in the first century BCE. The first century CE, and what is absolutely clear is the whole region was a pressure cooker about to explode. And it's not in the least surprising you get possibly apocalyptic figures like Jesus saying, I am something special. And again, Josephus tells us about lots of people who claimed they were the Messiah, lots of people who provoked the Romans because they had extreme religious opinions. We know the whole thing was ripe for this. And if you've watched Monty Python's Life of Brian, there's a bit where they wander through the marketplace and everyone is going, oh, I am the holy this. And you know, there are all these prophets. It was just like that. It really was. There are all sorts of people with lots of exciting new religious ideas. And probably in his original context, Jesus was one of them and quite typical of his time. But he was the one who people ran with. So I don't know, maybe he had some special charismatic quality. But definitely his followers lasted, whereas other people's followers didn't last. There might be all sorts of reasons for that. Okay, so what are the ingredients in our pressure cooker? First of all, politics, naturally. And we can reconstruct quite a bit about the land of Israel at this time, with Josephus, of course, with various Greek and Roman writers who do tell us a bit. We have some Jewish writings, not all of the mainstream. Some of the Dead Sea Scrolls throw a lot of light on the Jewish religious landscape. And before anyone asks, the Dead Sea Scrolls do not mention Jesus or Christians. At all, not one of them. And the main impression we get is a land in turmoil under foreign occupation, with several ethnic groups belonging to more than one religion and with subgroupings within each religion. So we'll just do a very quick whiz through what was going on. So by the mid first century BCE, the Hasmonean dynasty of Hanukkah fame had disintegrated into a set of squabbling rivals, all jockeying for the high priesthood and the kinship. And in 67 BCE, two Hasmonean brothers, Yohanan Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II, appealed foolishly to the rising Roman power to decide which of them should be king. And the Romans lost no time in deciding this offered them the golden opportunity, and they invaded under Pompey in 63 BCE and eventually took control of the whole area. So that was a stupid thing to do. And from this point onwards, the Romans are in charge. And the land of Israel became one of the theatres in which Roman civil wars and power struggles were played out. And some people played their cards very cleverly, notably Antipater. Antipater was an Idumean, an Edomite, and us lovely, peaceful Jewish people under the Hasmoneans had forcibly converted the Edomites to Judaism with varying levels of success at this period. The Hasmoneans were great ones for religious wars. They killed lots of Samaritans too. So Antipater was sort of thinly Jewish, you could say, and he was a clever man, and he managed to switch his allegiance back and forwards to whichever Roman leader was on top at the time and survived all the changes between, you know, Julius Caesar, Mark Antony, and so on. And his son Herod, whom you may have heard of, followed the same policy. So they survived the change of power from Julius Caesar to his assassin Brutus, then his rival Mark Antony, and finally his successor Octavian, who became the emperor Augustus. And in 40 BCE, Herod had done this so successfully that the Roman Senate made him king of Judea, a post he kept till 4 BCE, when his kingdom was split between his three sons, who are referred to in the New Testament. The Herods that appear in the New Testament are Herod's sons. And the sons were very unsatisfactory rulers, and the Romans thought, you know, were fed up with this dynasty, and they switched to direct rule, hence procurators, governors, including Pontius Pilate. And they were never very good quality, because Judea was not the place you wanted to be. Egypt was the place you could make a fortune. But Judea was a bit backward, and the local inhabitants were difficult. So who was there? There were, of course, Jews. They were speaking mostly Aramaic and some Greek at this point. They lived in central Judea and the Galilee. Galilee was thought of as a bit backward. And of course, they lived in Jerusalem. There were also the Samaritans, who hated the Jews and were hated by the Jews. And they lived in Shomron in Samaria. And there were also Greek-speaking pagans who lived in the Hellenistic cities along the coast, like Jaffa and places like that, and also lived in what is now Jordan. The Jews were not united. Josephus speaks of four philosophies, or maybe ways of being Jewish. The Sadducees, who it used to be thought were wealthy and upper class and in control of the temple. It's now not quite so clear that that's what the Sadducees were about. The Pharisees, who do have a connection to our later rabbinic tradition, were not quite sure what, ancestral or just influential. They seem to have had influence among the common people. The Essenes, who disapproved of the religious establishment and lived in separate communities, possibly, but not definitely, identical with the people down at Qumran who apparently wrote the Dead Sea Scrolls. We don't know. And there are other, the other one that is listed by Josephus is the Zealots, a violent and nationalistic political faction who wanted to get rid of the Romans. And there must have been lots more groupings. And we don't know how many people belong to each. And Josephus is not particularly interested in just the people who were just Jewish and didn't seem to identify with one of these groups. He is writing for Greek-reading Romans. He's not writing for Jews. So when he says philosophies, he's trying to use a word that is familiar to his readers. And he's maybe, in the way we all simplify when we're trying to explain Jewish things to people outside Judaism, you've probably done this yourself, trying to explain the Seder, for instance. What is it? Well, it's a sort of ceremonial meal, and you read, they're not exactly prayers, the Haggadah, that sort of, you know, you're familiar with this. So it's the temptation is to say, it's the prayer book we use during our ceremonial meal, which is slightly off, but is easier than explaining the whole thing. So it's entirely possible that Josephus was giving a somewhat partial or simplistic picture of what was really going on. It does seem to be very various, with lots of groups who all loathed each other. The Egyptian Jewish writer Philo, who lives roughly at the same time, a little bit earlier than Josephus, describes groups called the Therapeutae, who seem to have been sort of monastic-y type groups of Jews who lived in the desert communally and did a lot of praying, we're not sure. And altogether, it was very, very confused. So we have this political situation under the Roman procurators, revolts endlessly, not just the ones we know about. The big one is the one we know about, 66 or 70, which leads the Romans to burn the whole temple down, etc., with effects that we are still feeling today. What about economically? Well, again, most people were peasants. There was international trade, especially through the cities on the coast, which tended to be Greek-speaking and more urbanized, more sophisticated. There were inland trading routes. There's some evidence that maybe land was being concentrated in the hands of aristocrats, and there were more and more landless peasants around, which would definitely hot things up. We've spoken a little bit about the ethnicity of people. We've said the Jews, the Samaritans, the Idumeans, who were, remember, forcibly converted, so maybe weren't all that Jewish, maybe wanted to go back to their original ways. There were people described as Greeks, which means Greek speakers, but they came from all over the Mediterranean along the coast. Some might have had partially local descent. And there were, of course, the Romans, soldiers, administrators, traders, all over the place in the cities and forts that are controlling the areas. So you've got lots of people, different types of religion. You've got the Sadducees, we talked about the Pharisees, the Essenes Therapeuti, the Bothusians, who were mentioned in the mission. We don't know a thing about them, except the rabbis didn't like them. And who knows? There's also a mysterious group called the God-fearers mentioned in the New Testament, who seem to be non-Jews who like coming to shul and practice a certain level of sort of like fans of Jews. They're not technically Jews, but they're an outer ring of people who come along and observe certain things. And they lasted centuries. Early Christian writers sometimes rebuke these people and say, you must stop going to the synagogues and settle down and be good Christians. Samaritans, again, they might have had sects of their own. All the pagan religions would have been around, like the mystery cults such as those of Adonis and Isis, and the official cult of the Roman emperor, which would have been in anywhere where the Romans were, any cities, where the procurator lived, where the governor of this district lived, where the armies were stationed, all that would have been going on. And from about 40 C onwards, followers of Jesus, how do they fit into this mix? We're not sure. At the beginning, mostly Jewish, increasingly non-Jewish in origin. Later on, they're called Christians. We've seen the Romans noting that there's a group called the Christians a bit later. Other names include things like Ebionites, from the Hebrew Evion, those who are poor, who seem to have been Jewish followers of Jesus, who eventually get phased out in a couple of centuries. So that's what we know. And what we don't know. So the whole thing was a bit crazy. And in the middle of this, all this tension and groups and people didn't like each other, there were several people who claimed to be messianic figures. Josephus mentions a Samaritan Messiah who attracted thousands of followers and also was killed by the Romans. Some figures who Josephus describes as bandits were probably thought of as messiahs by their particular followers. So the whole thing is like a pressure cooker. And Jesus is just one of many of these exciting people who are wandering around in this very, very unstable environment. So you could see the whole thing is ripe. It's a heaving, fermenting mess. And one of the elements in the lead up to that terrible Jewish revolt didn't work against the Romans that led to the destruction of the temple was Jesus. He was a probably quite small element in all of that, but he takes off afterwards. And that may have a lot to do with the groups who were phased out of existence with destruction of the temple. Some groups didn't survive the destruction of the temple. We never hear of Sadducees afterwards. We don't hear of the Essenes afterwards. But some groups survived and some didn't. There seems to be some evidence that early followers of Jesus ran away from Jerusalem and moved over the Jordan to Philadelphia and survived there. So that may be one reason why Christianity did eventually take off and didn't just disappear with some of the other odd groups at the time. So next week, we're going to read the gospel accounts and look at the faith view. Today has been the historical view. And there's a little bibliography here. I just wanted to sort of explain about that. There's this wonderful book I cited by Charlotte Allen, The Human Christ, A Search for the Historical Jesus, which is just fascinating. Amy Jill Levine has written a fabulous, this is always a really good book to start with if you want to look at Christian-Jewish relations, The Misunderstood Jew, The Church and the Scandal of the Jewish Jesus. If you want to look at the New Testament itself with the Jewish commentary, there is the wonderful Jewish annotated New Testament with fabulous essays in the back of it. Can't recommend it enough. And Bart Ehrman has written lots and lots of very interesting books about early Christianity. And again, this is Jesus before the Gospels. early Christian accounts of who Jesus was, where they come from, how they change, and so on. Again, anything by Bart Ehrman, I really, really recommend. So I hope that is useful. I'm just going to have a very quick look at the chat. Let's just see, because there were a couple of other things in the chat. Well, I can't see the chat. Oh, there it is. Go down the bottom. Did the living Jesus actually say he was the Messiah? What did it happen by his followers? Depends on which gospel you read. There's one point where people ask him, are you the Messiah? And he says, well, you say I am. But there are other places where he seems to say it more. Again, remember these documents were written after his lifetime. So, you know, what is the relationship between what he actually said and what the documents portray in this thing? We don't know. Here we have, when the Pope was in Canada a while back, references made him going to St. Anne's. It's explained that Anne was Jesus's grandmother. Traditionally, yes. I don't think she appears in the Gospels, but quite early Christian tradition assigned her a mother called Anne, Hannah, probably as a sort of weaving in of the story of Hannah in the Bible into the sort of resonances in early Christianity. So yes, she's an old tradition, but I don't think she appears in the Gospels. Can the bibliography be emailed to all? Well, it's on the handout, so you've got access to that. Has Jesus been Christian? Barry Wilson, never heard of it. Sounds interesting. Yeah, there are a lot of very interesting books out there. Again, you want to look at the credentials of the person who wrote them, because there's some wacky stuff out there too. So just make sure they're a respectable person who hasn't got a particular weird axe to grind, and read around it. The basic bottom line on the historical Jesus is we don't have enough evidence. We just pretty sure existed, but we don't really know very much about it. And I've seen another request to re-enter the handout. Let me just copy and paste that. Or maybe she has done it already. Let's have a look. Oh, he's a professor at York University. Well, I'd read that then. That sounds great. There we are. There's the handout. So see you next week. We will examine the Gospels and their links back and echoes of the Tanakh and why they do that. And look at a basic story of who is Jesus and what happens to him in the faith view. Okay, see you next week.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks everyone for coming.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Excellent.
Chodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov. Yes, indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chodesh Tov.
You're welcome. You're absolutely welcome. See you next week. Stay warm.
Bye.